This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rebecca Roberts. Senate Democrats are hoping for an early August vote to confirm President Barack Obama's new nominee to the Supreme Court. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the high court confirmation process. But first, if Elena Kagan is confirmed to a seat on the Supreme Court, it will lead to an Ivy League clean sweep. And not just any Ivy, every justice will have attended law school at either Harvard or Yale. Should a diploma from one of the nation's top two law schools be a prerequisite for a job on the court? NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The rise of the Harvard-Yale hegemony is not new in Washington. Each of the last four presidents passed through these two institutions. Elena Kagan would replace John Paul Stevens, who attended lowly Northwestern University Law School, only number 11 on the U.S. News rankings. Harvard and Yale's half-Nelson grip on entry to the high court is a little odd to some observers, especially those from different time zones. Dan Farber teaches at the seventh-best law school, also known as Berkeley Law.
It does seem kind of weird, for example, that Stanford, which is, you know, ranked right up there with Harvard and Yale, doesn't have now any of that representation.
The idea that someone from Berkeley would complain about a slight against arch-rival Stanford shows just how surprised some Westerners are about their total shutout from the court. Stanford, ranked number 3, sent both William Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor to the high court. Author Nicholas Lemon says the Harvard-Yaleification of the court marks a resurgent elitism in American society.
It really represents an unstated but quite powerful consensus that there's a narrow channel through which you have to pass to be a Supreme Court justice.
Lemon says the Kagan nomination points to a growing lack of diversity when it comes to background and experience. He says this cautious strategy dictates,
if they haven't done certain things by the time they're 25 or 30, game over.
Gone are the days, Lemon says, when experience in politics, as with former California Governor Earl Warren, was seen as a gateway to the court. Others look at the Harvard-Yale nexus and say, so what? Professor Pamela Carlin of Stanford Law says your education resume just isn't that important in the final analysis.
I don't think anybody is nominated for the Supreme Court because of what they did as a child.
Elena Kagan graduated from Harvard way back in 1986, although since then she served as law school dean there from 2003 to 2009, so her ties to that school are awfully strong. Still, Pam Carlin says we shouldn't make too much of what is essentially a coincidence.
Graduates of elite universities do all sorts of things in their professional careers, just as graduates of not particularly selective law schools often go on to elite positions.
And many observers say the Harvard-Yale pedigree is just a safety net that helps preempt potential criticism of a nominee's bona fides. And the truth is, using top schools as a filter makes life simpler for busy presidents and for Supreme Court justices when they choose their clerks. Justice Antonin Scalia, Harvard class of 1960, admitted as much in an address last year when he said his favorite court clerk was Jeff Sutton, whom he inherited from Justice Lewis Powell.
Well, I wouldn't have hired Jeff Sutton. For God's sake, he went to Ohio State.
Scalia wasn't being ironic. He said he believed the best schools admit the best and the brightest. The chief flaw with the Yale-Harvard test is that it leaves out people who couldn't get into those schools, which is to say, most of us. In 1970, Senator Roman Hruska defended High Court nominee G. Harold Carswell against the charge that he was mediocre. Hruska said, there are a lot of mediocre judges and people and lawyers. They're entitled to a little representation, aren't they? Apparently, they are not. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Now, in Northern California, there are three counties that make up an area informally known as the Emerald Triangle. And together, these counties produce more marijuana than anywhere else in the country. For years, the war on drugs and frequent crackdowns have kept the price of pot relatively high. But ever since California voters legalized the use of so-called medical marijuana, competitors have flooded the market. So the wholesale price of marijuana is sinking. And as Michael Montgomery now reports, it's been an economic catastrophe for the Emerald Triangle.
Back in 1983, the Reagan administration launched a massive air and ground campaign to eradicate pot and lock up growers in Northern California. Charlie Custer, a writer and community activist, had just arrived to Humboldt County from Chicago. With the Reagan crackdown, Custer recalls wholesale pot prices shot up to as high as $5,000 a pound. That sudden and ironic windfall for those growers willing to risk prison time transformed the community.
A lot of people were living on welfare and peanut butter and banana sandwiches for a long time before pot made it possible to become members of the middle class.
Nearly 30 years later, Custer says that boom may be over.
Outdoor growers are having a hard time unloading their fall harvest. And when some people do move it, they don't get anything like the price they were hoping for.
That goes for both legal growers who cultivate limited quantities of pot under California's medical marijuana laws and illegal operators who often grow larger amounts. Prices are now well under $2,000 a pound, according to interviews with more than a dozen growers and dealers. Mendocino County Sheriff Tom Allman says some growers can't get rid of their processed pot at any price.
We arrested a guy who had, now listen to this, 800 pounds of processed. 800 pounds of process. And we asked him, what were you going to do with 800 pounds of process? He said, I don't know.
Anybody want to find out what the best pot in the world is this year?
As recently as last December, things were still pretty upbeat. At Area 101, an events and healing center near the town of Laytonville, local growers gathered to celebrate the Emerald Cup, an annual competition for the season's best pot buds.
Yeah! All right.
But the host of the event, Tim Blake, says the mood has darkened since then.
There's a tremendous amount of concern borderlining on fear.
Blake is a former underground grower who now cultivates medical marijuana. He says the drop in pot prices is in part the result of more growers and a more tolerant legal landscape. But he says another factor is quality. Indoor-grown marijuana is increasingly favored by dispensaries and consumers for its looks, consistency, and potency. It costs more to produce than pot grown under the sun, but commands a higher price, as much as double. That's one reason retail prices haven't hit the skids.
What's happening is the people that don't have quality product aren't selling it. Okay, and so they're the ones that are creating this panic. Just like in every other agriculture industry, when you get too many vineyards and too many people growing vines out there, then only the good ones make it.
Matt Cohen is one of those growers who's making it. On an organic farm near Ukiah, Cohen raises chickens, grows vegetables, and cultivates high-grade medical pot.
This is a secure outdoor growing area.
He's avoided the downturn by distributing marijuana directly to patients. But other growers who rely on middlemen and dealers for legal and illegal sales are in financial trouble.
They're living from credit card to credit card, you know. They're not even making money. It's just a lifestyle that they're in, and the alternative is to go do what?
In recent weeks, the upheaval has spurred a series of unprecedented public forums about where things are headed for the marijuana industry, especially if Californians vote to legalize pot this fall. Local activist Anna Hamilton organized this gathering in the town of Garberville. She says the broader community is already feeling the ripple effects of falling pot prices.
There has been business closures, storefronts closing. There's a lot of instability and anxiety.
Still, amid the turmoil, Charlie Custer says some locals haven't lost their sense of humor. Custer recalls a recent musical review where three performers in miniskirts, sunglasses, and spiky heels mocked the plight of local pot growers, all to the beat of the 60s hit, My Boyfriend's Back.
My dealer's back and I'm gonna get ready. Hey now, hey now, my dealer's back. And it was a song of hope in this hopeless situation. It'll happen to you too. Your dealer will come back.
Or maybe not. California's pot economy is transforming and starting to resemble a real commodities market where only big players can compete. It's a shift that could leave some growers in this part of the state in the dust. For NPR News, I'm Michael Montgomery.
Our story was produced as part of a collaboration between member station KQED and the Center for Investigative Reporting's California Watch Project.
And with the U.S. unemployment rate at nearly 10%, states are experimenting with ways to get people back to work. One program called Georgia Works lets workers keep their unemployment benefits while they go through on-the-job training. State leaders say it's an innovative way to get people back into the job market, but critics say employers are getting help for free. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
There are 15 million unemployed workers in the U.S., and up until January, Melissa Brown was one of them.
Brown had worked as a clerk for an international shipping company, but was laid off in 2008. She wanted to use her accounting degree, but had little luck because there were so few jobs. When she did get an interview, prospective employers gave her the same response.
I showed, you know, gave them my resume, and they said, well, you don't have any experience in accounting. I could do the work, but I didn't have any experience.
Brown joined Georgia Works, which pairs employers and employees. The program offers part-time training for up to 6 weeks. Employees learn a new skill and continue to get paid their weekly unemployment benefits, plus a stipend to offset travel and childcare costs. Brown got the training and ultimately landed a job at National Tax Negotiators in Fayetteville, Georgia, as a full-time accountant. She adds up piles of receipts for a client as she prepares his taxes.
Yeah, sometimes these are old receipts, so I have to look and see if I can read the numbers.
Joyce Travis owns the business. She says she hired workers in the past and paid to train them, but it didn't work out. Without the program, Travis says she might not have been able to afford to hire another employee.
6 weeks may not seem like a lot of money, but it is a lot of money if you put your time into training that person and you pay them good, and then they don't work out. It really cuts into your budget.
In Georgia, the unemployment rate is above the national average at 10.6%. The region is just beginning to see signs of recovery, but state officials say they have to be more innovative if they're going to get people back to work. The Georgia Works program began in 2003, and the state has recently been running radio ads to attract more interest in it.
We've been through some tough times before, but nothing compares to what we're facing now. To be honest with you, I never had much faith in government programs, but the Georgia Department of Labor has a great new initiative called Georgia Works.
So far, almost 8,400 employers have signed up, and about 7,800 workers have participated in training. Businesses are not required to hire workers, and those who don't get jobs will continue to receive their unemployment checks. But nearly half of the trainees, more than 3,700 people, now have jobs. Georgia Labor Commissioner Michael Thurmond calls that a success.
The average length of duration of unemployment in Georgia is now at about 15 weeks. So when a person is hired within 6 weeks, then you've saved 9 weeks of unemployment insurance benefits. And that has generated some $6 million in savings for our unemployment insurance trust fund.
But there are critics. One workers' rights group says Georgia Works violates federal labor laws because employers are getting work without having to pay for it. Maurice Emsalem is with the National Employment Law Project.
They want to call it training, which is exempt from the minimum wage, but only under very strict circumstances. And that requires that the person is receiving 100% training and the employer is deriving no benefit from the program. And clearly that's not the situation with Georgia Works.
Emsalem says employers should pay at least minimum wage, and he says state and federal officials should monitor the program to make sure companies are not taking advantage of workers. But Georgia Labor Commissioner Thurmond says the criticism is unfounded and the training legal. He says the voluntary program gives workers new skills to add to their resume and creates jobs that would not exist.
This stimulates hiring and reduces the cost of training. It addresses the major issue facing private sector employers today.
The U.S. Department of Labor recently issued 10 pages of legal guidelines outlining what is allowed in worker training programs, but officials declined to be interviewed for this story. Other states are setting up incentives for employers, including paying companies subsidies if they hire workers who are now receiving unemployment checks. Mark Zandi is an economist with Moody's Analytics. He says these are exactly the kind of strategies states should be trying.
I think in normal times, I don't think anyone would be thinking down these lines, but these aren't normal times, and we've got a big problem, and we need to figure out ways, creative ways to solve it, and Georgia Works is a shot at it.
Back in Fayetteville, Georgia, Melissa Brown is now employed after being out of work for more than a year, and she's clearly beaming about her new job.
I'm actually doing something that I want to do, and I don't mind getting up in the morning, coming, staying late. I love my job.
The Georgia Labor Commissioner says he'd like to expand the program in this state and across the country. More than 20 states have contacted Georgia to get more information, and New Hampshire began a similar initiative just last month. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
This is NPR.
The rise of China's economy is offering other countries, other governments, an alternative to the free market system. It could be called state-controlled capitalism. And if that sounds something like a contradiction in terms, Ian Bremmer is here to explain it. His new book is The End of the Free Market. In it, he writes that the rise of state capitalism poses a serious challenge to U.S. companies. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's begin with your definition of state capitalism.
Well, state capitalism is when the state is the principal actor and judge in the economy and uses the markets for ultimately political gains. Where in a market economy, multinational corporations are the principal economic actors.
Let's get some examples of the tension between free market corporations and their state-controlled competitors. One pretty startling statistic you have is that the world's oil production is controlled by state-owned oil companies, 75% controlled.
That's right. And of course, that wasn't always the case. In fact, an easy way to think about this is in the days before national oil corporations, if you were a big oil company, you could go up to a dictator, sign a deal, you'd give them some cash, and you'd stick a straw in the ground. Suddenly, there was a rise of state oil corporations when these dictators realized they had their own straws. And if you were an international energy company, you were out of the straw business. That's not just happening in oil. That's happening across the board.
We're now hearing more about the Chinese car industry, which is state-owned.
That's right. No, you look at aviation, too, and you ask me if Airbus or Boeing is going to have a business selling aircraft in China once they actually get up to speed technologically in building their airplanes. It's coming a lot faster than people think. I think the answer is clearly no. And there are many, many multinational corporations based in the West that thought that they were going to be able to do great business. And suddenly they're going to find that they have real competitors on the ground in the world's second largest and fastest growing economy. But it's not a fair playing field. There is no rule of law. And they're going to get Googled out. They're going to have the same problems that our friends with the world's largest search engine have just had.
You write in a government-controlled capitalistic system, commercial decisions are often left to political bureaucrats and distorted by political goals. What would be a good example of that?
A great example of that would be what you see in Venezuela, where President Hugo Chavez has used their oil company to fund everything from the creation of apartments to agricultural policy. And as a consequence, they haven't actually reinvested at all, which means that Venezuela runs a deficit if oil is under $85 a barrel. They have systematically destroyed their economy. Any multinational corporation would be producing much more oil. They'd have more money to tax, but the inefficiencies of the state are legion.
Do you really, though, envision at any point the end of the free market system?
We are no longer in a global free market economy. The United States is still a free market. Europe is still a free market. Japan is still a free market. But the world's second largest economy and fastest growing out of the global recession is not. And now there are two systems out there. There's a free market system, largely in the developed world. There is a state capitalist system in China, in Russia, in the Persian Gulf. The systems are ultimately mutually incompatible. When your principal actors are multinational corporations in the private sector and they rely for their growth on unfettered access to global markets and state capitalist systems don't do that, you're going to have a problem. And we are just at the beginning of that problem.
Well, in the end, who do you see winning? I mean, towards the end of the book, you write free markets will probably outlast state capitalism.
I ultimately think that's true. The United States has a bigger economy, puts more money into research and development. The educational institutions are stronger. But the United States, Japan, and Europe are not going to be getting their act together globally tomorrow. We know what the unemployment numbers are. We know what the deficit situation is. We're digging ourselves out of a hole. And so as a consequence, over the next 5 to 10 years, the fight is going to get much more obvious.
Thank you very much for joining us.
No, my pleasure, Renee.
Ian Bremmer is the president of the Eurasia Group, a political risk research and consulting firm. His new book is The End of the Free Market: Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations?